Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. There is no arguing that a plane crash resulting in the deaths of most of those on board is a momentous occurrence, and Charlotte was the site of just such a crash. On September 11, 1974, Eastern Airlines Flight 212 from Charleston, South Carolina, was on approach to Douglas Airport but never made it. The plane crashed through trees, being torn apart in the process, finally stopping in a cornfield about 3 miles from the airport, the wreckage engulfed in an inferno. On that foggy morning, 72 of the 82 passengers lost their lives. But now, 50 years later, few remember that crash. And there are no plaques, no memorial to recognize the tragedy or even mark the site. But a recent series in the Charlotte Observer attempted to change that. In 5 remarkable installments, modern readers learned about the tragedy, the people involved, and heard from some of the survivors. And this hour, we will too. We're joined by 2 of the co-authors of this series, 2 of the best writers this city can boast, Scott Fowler and Thaden Janes. Welcome back to both of you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Mike. Glad
Thanks
to be here.
Thanks for having us, Mike.
You're welcome. And Richard Arnold is also with us bright and early, well, dark and early in Oregon, or Washington State is where he is this morning. He's a survivor of Eastern Airlines Flight 212 on that fateful morning. Thank you for being with us, Richard. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. Thank you.
Thaden, the Observer devoted a lot of newsprint to this. It was a 5-part series. How did this series come to be? What piqued your interest and curiosity? How did you pitch it?
Well, I would love for Scott to tell the story that I've heard several times, but I think that he should take this one because it really came from him. And I went along for the ride because I was just saw a great storytelling opportunity that was very that I felt could be incredibly moving. But Scott, do you want to tell the story of how you found out about it in the first place? Because I had never heard of the crash.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. Mike and Thaden and Richard all. What happened, Mike, was basically I was listening to a podcast, and it was Anderson Cooper's podcast on CNN about grief. You ever heard that one?
I heard that podcast. I listened to that series, and I heard his interview with Richard Colbert. I mean, Stephen Colbert.
Colbert, exactly. And so in Colbert's interview, he talks about the great tragedy of his life. This podcast is about grief and really good. But anyway, Colbert goes, yeah, I lost my father and 2 of my brothers in this horrendous plane crash, and it colored really my entire existence. And I was only 10 years old at the time, and I knew there had been some tragedy in his life, but I wasn't quite sure what. And then he said, and it was in Charlotte, North Carolina in 1974. And I was like, what? Charlotte, North Carolina? I've worked here for 30 years. I talked to people in the newsroom. I'm like, well, somehow there's a big blind spot in my life here. How did I not know about this crash, which was the deadliest ever in Charlotte history? Turned out no one in the newsroom knew about it. I talked to Thaden about it, and I was like, wow, this seems like a really interesting project that we should tackle because people need to know about this thing. And that's how it started.
Richard Arnold certainly knows about it because he lived through it. And I've never spoken to a survivor of an airplane crash. Richard, how traumatic has this experience been for you? Is it something that you think about a lot? Do you remember the incident that day, September the 11th, 1974, relatively clearly? Or is it kind of misty by this time, 50 years later?
Well, of course, I've thought about it ever since. The days of the what happened that day is clear, and my life was basically turned into 4 parts. It was the crash, the recovery, the trial, and the appeals. And what's the rest of my life going to be like? And focusing on those things, and it was a progress through all those different stages.
We're going to talk about
when it didn't happen.
We're going to talk about what you went through during that crash and in the months and years after that crash as we go through the program. Thaden, you point out in your stories the flight of this DC-9 from Charleston, South Carolina to Charlotte should have been uneventful. but it wasn't. And you begin from Richard Arnold's point of view, and a frightening one at that, with him looking out the window of this airplane on approach to the airport and seeing a wide-eyed face staring up at him, and then another face staring up at him. And he wasn't alone. Other survivors that you spoke with saw things that let them know that something was going very wrong here. I wonder if you had a chance to ask, which was worse for these folks, knowing that something bad was about to happen, and they're not driving the bus, they're sitting in the back with no control, or the aftermath of what they had to live through? Which was worse for these folks?
Well, I think if you've seen the documentary that we produced, I mean, I think that they thought the worst part was knowing, and then the worst part happened, and that was worse. Bob Burnham had that great quote that was something to the effect of, you know, the plane crashed. He thought to himself, so this is what it's like to die in a plane crash. That wasn't so bad. And then he says, it got bad. It got real bad. And just the thing you mentioned about seeing faces on the ground, I would love to hear Richard talk more about that. But, you know, Scott and I both, when we heard that, we thought, is that really possible that you could see? I've been on an airplane dozens, maybe hundreds of times, and never really thought about whether you could see a face on the ground if you were only 100 feet on the ground, because it's just whizzing by so fast. Well, I've thought about that since, and you could actually, that's actually possible.
Yeah, Richard.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so to think about how horrifying that must have been for Richard.
Well, I was going to ask, Richard, this is a short puddle jumper flight from Charleston to Charlotte. I think it was 37 minutes or something like that in the air, if that. Went uneventfully up until that moment. When you looked out the window casually, probably, I don't know what you were expecting to see, but when you saw what you saw, what did that feel like?
Well, he made a procedural turn, a zigzag pattern, as he lined up with the airport. And at that point, I could see the airport approach lights. We were perfectly on the glide path. I knew this was going to be no problem at all. We're going to land any few moments. When we went over that factory where the strike was going on, we were so close. I could read that guy's lips, and he was yelling, gesturing, pull up, pull up, pull up. And I did not think we were going to crash. I just thought we were unusually low. I waved back at him. I've always wanted to know who he was and talk with him. Wow. But I'm told he suffered quite a bit from that experience, and that he couldn't save the plane.
There were fewer runways at Douglas Airport back in 1974, Scott, because it hadn't exploded into the airport that it is today. So there were fewer landing paths, it seemed to me. But talk about where this plane went down, because if nobody knows about this crash, they certainly don't know where it took place. Where in Charlotte did this happen?
Well, if you drove down South Tryon Street today, Mike, there's a church there called Rod of God. And Rod of God, behind it, the Rod of God pastoral team, the Allens, were kind enough to let us go back in their private woods back there. But that's where the plane went down. It now is complete. You can't see a single thing other than woods in there and houses. That's what's there. That some of that land has now been developed. And some people live on top of where this plane crashed and don't even know about it. It's all quite strange, in fact, that this, you know, and some of that plane, Mike, is literally still there, because it was, some of the carcass was buried. All the people had been taken out at that point, survivors and victims. But the plane itself, some of it is actually underground about 30 feet down, and some of it was sold for scrap. But yeah, no one knows really where that happened. But it's if you know where the Rod of God Church is, it's about, like you said, 3 miles from the 3 miles short of the runway.
In the online version of this story at charlotteobserver.com, Richard, you talk about the reaction of a truck driver who was on the ground. He pulled over so that he would not hit the plane, if this story is accurate. He clearly saw the plane. Through the course of the trials that you attended and went through, did it ever come out that the pilots, if he saw the plane, why didn't the pilots see him?
I don't know. The only answer I have is they weren't looking out the window. I heard the pilot speak at a meeting in Atlanta. He said there was fog, 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 and he never saw the runway. That tells me one thing. He never looked out the window.
Wow. Scott and Thayden, you were able to sift through a trove of recently discovered interviews with the crash survivors conducted by the National Transportation Safety Board just days after the crash. And in that online version of the story that people can go to, you shared some of those recordings. And Thayden, you just referred to one of these. Here's how Bob Burnham and Scott Johnson remembered this experience.
They were descending. They just kept descending. And you can see tops of trees sticking up through the ground fog and all that. I said, there's something wrong here. It hit and, the plane exploded as soon as it hit.
It was just like you see in a movie, exactly like it. Everything is shaking, the lights flashing on and off, and then this fireball comes down through the fuselage.
And I can remember, as I was losing consciousness, thinking to myself, so this is what it's like to get killed in a plane crash. That wasn't so bad. Well, I got that wrong, because it got bad. It got real bad.
We're going to talk about that in a moment because we've spoken on this program many times to Kathy Reichs, who is a forensic anthropologist who goes to plane crash sites. And we'll talk about what that experience was like for the survivors of that plane crash when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. Okay, we're back with Charlotte Talks, and we're talking about a five-part series that recently appeared on the Charlotte Observer about a plane crash that most people living here don't know about, the crash of 212, Eastern Airlines Flight 212 on September the 11th. Now, there's a bad date. In 1974, Scott Fowler and Thayden Janes are the co-authors of that series in the Observer, and Richard Arnold is a survivor of that Eastern Airlines flight, also the author of his own book about it called The Crash of Eastern Flight 212. We just heard from two survivors of that crash a moment before we went to the break, Thayden. And I mentioned that we had spoken to Kathy Reichs on this program several times, in addition to being the person, the novelist behind the Bones series of books, the Tempe Brennan series, and the Bones TV series. She is, in fact, a forensic anthropologist who has been called on to go to these crash sites and investigate what exactly happened. And she has told us several times that this is going to these sites is something that most people would not want to endure. It is gruesome. And clearly, this plane crashed through stands of trees, and 72 of the 82 people on board died. Is the miracle here that anybody survived at all, Thayden?
Probably. I mean, I think that the statistic is that 32 died on impact. So that means there were dozens that were still technically alive after the plane came to its final resting place. So the suffering that went on among the people who were on that plane is unimaginable. I mean, we saw some photographs that we did not publish that fortunately were in black and white. So to think about what those 10 survivors saw and what those dozens of people who were suffering from horrible injuries before they died and literally suffering from them saw, it's pretty awful to think about.
Yeah, I don't want to get too gruesome here because why do that? But I know that you spoke to some of the first responders on the scene, one of whom was relatively new to the job and pulled himself out of the crash scene because he couldn't take it. He went back and served food and water to people coming toward the ambulances when they needed to get on board those ambulances. How many of the first responders, Scott, did you folks talk to?
We talked to several, and then, you know, Mike, we also made, I should mention, there's a 30-minute video documentary that we've made on this, too, that is on YouTube. It's very easy to find. You just search 9/11/74. And we had a premiere of that last week, and we had several of those first responders actually came to it, which was really cool. And talking to those guys, it's much, you know, their story is different than Richard's, but not that much, because what they saw and experienced was traumatic and deeply embedded in them even today. And as you say, with Kathy Reichs, it's a gruesome scene. And a lot of people from Charlotte, there were only two people from Charlotte on the plane, Mike, but there were dozens and dozens and hundreds, really, once you started adding up all the different hospitals and first responders and all these firefighters that responded, who actually experienced it. I'd say 99% of Charlotte never knew this crash existed today, but the 1% that does, it is really deeply embedded.
Richard, as this series reports, the survivors of this crash were not sitting in one section of the airplane. They were all over the airplane. Most of them, six of the 10 who ultimately survived, were in the toward the rear of the plane. Where were you sitting, and what was the situation with the people sitting around you once this plane had stopped moving and was on the ground?
Well, I was sitting in the just behind the partition where first class starts. And apparently when the nose broke off, it broke off right there. So I was the first one not to be killed in first in that area. Next to me, there was an empty seat, and on the aisle, there was a Navy guy, young guy, and he was wearing the Navy whites, going home, whatever, I don't know. And I saw him die. It's absolutely terrible thing. But once I got out of the airplane, I suffered from what the doctor said was psychic numbing. So the only person I saw after that was Roy Hendricks, which I helped to get out of the cornfield, and of course John McDowell. So in a sense, I blanked out all the horrible scenes that the first responders saw. Someone said, "Isn't this unusual?" And the doctor said, "No, it's not unusual. It's called psychic numbing. You only see the things that'll be useful to you." And for that was to get to the hospital and hopefully live.
It's been a long time. It's been 50 years, but I know that when people go through these incidences like this, the survivors sometimes suffer from survivor's guilt. Why me? Why did I survive and all these other people did not? Did you experience that?
Yes, but it was different. Eastern said to me one time that I caused the airplane crash, and I said, "How did I do that?" And he said, "It was in God's plan." I says, "Well, I don't think he needed to kill 72 people to give me a message." I never had, if you will, survivor's guilt, because I guess I was, in a sense, initially, perhaps, until I met Eastern, quite frankly. And that was part of the process of getting over it, addressing it in such incredible detail. And the trial was very healing process for me, because the people in Charlotte in the jury listened to me and listened to the other people who'd been there, and I said, finally these things are getting out. It was a remarkable experience. They hadn't invented the word PTSD yet, but they called it psychic numbing, and my focus was always on what's the next step, because I had to reunite with my kids. They needed help. I had to survive so I could help my kids. And that was what I was focused on. And I worked with the Medical University of South Carolina, and I knew many of the people there in the administration and some of the doctors. And I was surrounded by my friends. It was an astonishing experience going through the recovery in medical university.
PTSD seems to me to be slightly different than, I'm not a doctor, but it seems to be slightly different than the psychic numbing, because PTSD tends to last a long time, and it seems to recur and be triggered by certain things as you go through the rest of your life. Some of the other survivors, in addition to their physical injuries, also talk about suffering from PTSD for much of the rest of their lives. One of the passengers stopped regular church going after this incident. He was a regular churchgoer, and he never went back. After this was over, he never talked about the crash with his family or friends. The surviving flight attendant told her son that she never got over the crash and that she thought about it all the time. From what I understand from reading these articles by Thaden and Scott, you were the most severely injured survivor, but you do talk about it. So are these examples of just how people handle this differently? Why do you talk about it? What does it do for you?
I think I channeled my survivor's guilt into speaking for the people who died and trying to find some way to make the world a better place by telling pilots to look out the window during the landing. I think that was it also, and I was focused on living and being essentially paying back the rest of my community all the help I got. I worked with the Medical University for some years after that, and I felt a great sense of gratitude. And I think that's how I escaped the psychic numbing. Mm. But every September 11th, I would always, no matter where I was, I'd just take the day off and go sit in a park or in the woods somewhere and just be utterly silent by myself. I never explained to anybody what I was doing. I just left. And that's when I thought about it. I didn't think about it on a day-to-day basis. But every anniversary, I would hide myself away someplace, like on the banks of Mount Hood. The northern face of Mount Hood is one of my favorite places, a place called Karn Basin. I would just go there utterly alone in the woods and sit.
We should mention that Richard Arnold, one of the survivors of Flight 212, is with us this morning from Washington State, and that's what he's referring to there. Scott, one of the things that makes this series compelling is the humanization of it all, the way you tell the survivors' stories, but also the way you tell the stories of those who did not survive. How did you collect that information about the people who did not survive?
Yes, mainly by finding their relatives, Mike. We talked to a lot of sons and daughters of so many of people on the plane had children. And so largely many of these, conversations were with people who their lives have been deeply affected. If you can imagine yourself, you know, if your mom or dad got in a plane crash and it was kind of something that you dealt with as a family the rest of your lives. And so it affected, you know, these tentacles spread everywhere. So, and I should mention too that Richard, it's wonderful he's joining us today, and he's obviously starring in the show, Mike, over Thaden and I, which is absolutely correct because his story is unbelievable. But there's only three people left on that flight who are still alive. We found all three, but the other seven of the 10 survivors have died at this point of natural causes. So Richard is really one of a very few people left who has firsthand remembrances.
This airplane went through a stand of trees, and essentially the wings were torn off, and the fuselage broke, and those in front of it, most of the people in front of that break passed away. Although the co-pilot in the cockpit survived, as did a flight attendant who was seated in the front of the plane, looking back at the passengers, as is the way flight attendants sit on these aircraft. She survived. But the plane was full of fuel. It hit the ground and it burst into flames. And that's what caused many of the survivors to be so horribly injured. Richard, you were burned. You went through this horrific crash. You had the wherewithal to get out of the aircraft. You found a fellow passenger on the ground and you picked him up and carried him away from the burning airplane because you thought that it might explode at any minute. Where did that strength come from? Where did the courage to take that moment and not save yourself, but to save somebody else you didn't know come from?
Well, I always thought I was going to live. And where I got the strength, one of the doctors said, you've gone through an abnormally high amount of adrenaline and gives you strength and abilities you never thought you had. But experiencing it, all I knew is I had to get out of that burning plane, and I had to live because I had things I had to do.
I want to talk about that. I want to talk about that because immediately after the crash, you were flown to the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston. And in the third installment of this series in the Observer Online, they have embedded a recording of you recounting a conversation that you had with the doctor as you were being admitted to the hospital.
When I got to the hospital, they said, "You're going to die." I said, "What are my chances?" He said, 97 chance fatality. And I said, "I'll take the 3%. He said, "You don't know what you're getting into. It's the most painful way to die there is." I said, "Please." He said, "Okay." And I lived.
So many questions. First, why would a doctor tell you that you're going to die? And secondly, was he correct about the pain? And while you went through that 3.5 months of rehabilitation, was he right about the pain? Was
That's
it worth
true.
It?
That's what we do. And basically, as a medical university, you're a marvelous teaching case. Do you mind being a teaching case? He said, "No, I'd love to be the one to talk to you guys how to beat the odds."
And you said just prior to my playing that recording of you that you never thought you were going to die, and you opted to go through the pain and suffering to live. Do you think that that positive attitude played a role in your survival?
Of course. We had people in the burn unit who weren't burned that bad, weren't hurt that bad, and died within hours. So I certainly think it. The doctor said there's a huge psychic element. I had this one strange experience at the medical university when I was learning how to walk, and I walked in out the back door of the burn unit, and there's a classroom, and on the blackboards, three blackboards, huge blackboards, was my entire life, where I came from, who I was, where I worked, the Air Force experience, my mother's, my father, my children. I was all there, and there were things, nothing there was wrong, but there were things about me that I hardly knew. And this is what I think helped the medical team, because to know what your patient is like, know what their life is like, it helps you be a better doctor.
I have about 20 seconds left in this segment, but I'm just curious so our listeners know, how badly were you injured, and do those injuries linger today?
I pulled a burning double knit suit off my body with my left and right hands. That's how they got horribly burned. There's no, the skin on my back was gone in the back of my legs. I was sitting there, my pants had mostly come off. All I had was my belt and the pockets. The legs were all burned, melted off.
It was burned a lot. I want to remind people who didn't live through the 70s. In 1974, people were wearing double knit suits, and double knit was polyester, and it snagged a lot. But one of the characteristics of polyester is that it is flammable, so that's why it was seared into your skin. We're talking to Richard Arnold, survivor of Eastern Flight 212, which went down in Charlotte on September the 11th, 1974. And when we come back, we'll talk to Thaden James and Scott Fowler with The Observer about what happened as a result of this crash. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks, and today we're talking to Thaden James and Scott Fowler, the co-authors of a 5-part series on the Charlotte Observer, which is now on charlotteobserver.com, called about the flight of 9/11. It's called 9/11/74, the crash of flight 212, too many numbers, Eastern Airline, which happened on September 11, 1974, and we're also joined by Richard Arnold, one of the survivors of that crash. Thaden, you reported on cockpit recordings leading up to the crash, and both the pilot, Captain James Reeves, who died in the crash, and co-pilot and first officer Jim Daniels, who did not, seemed focused on finding, in the fog, some new attraction at Carowinds. This is evidently a flight that they had taken many times, and they were engulfed in conversations and trying to find this new attraction at Carowinds. Reeves was an experienced pilot. His co-pilot had about half the experience, but still quite a number of flight hours under his belt. How did they lose track of where they were? How did they lose track of how high off the ground or how low to the ground they were?
They had become complacent. I mean, I think that they had done it so many times, particularly Reeves, who was the head pilot, that they just figured that they knew where they were and they weren't aware, because they were having a couple things were going on. One was this conversation, which we outlined, and which is their transcripts of the conversation, which just goes, it's all kinds of small talk. It seemed like they hit every range of like topical and in some cases sort of inappropriate topics that they could cover. They were talking about politics. Nixon had resigned the month before. We talked about a used car that they had bought for the that one of them had bought for their sons. They were talking about desegregation. But the other thing that was going on was they were trying to use the Carowinds Tower as this visual cue. It had become sort of a waypoint for pilots making that approach from the south into Douglas Airport. They just didn't know, they weren't sure whether or not they had passed it. And they were pretty focused on that when they should have been focused on the altimeters, which were showing clearly that they were too low to the ground.
In fact, Mike, one of those altimeters, it was a warning. It was going off, and they cut the altimeter warning off because it was annoying to pilots back then, because it went off so often. It was almost like it cried wolf. But in this case, it was absolutely warning, you're too low, and they knocked that off. And you're right about Carowinds, if you remember, was only open like for a year. So it was like a brand new thing. And at one point, one of them says, yeah, Carowinds, wow, it's supposed to be real nice. So they're obviously just not focused on the right things. Richard had the best line about it, probably. He told Thaden and during our reporting, it was a textbook example of distracted driving. That's what was going on. It was distracted driving in the era, pre-cell phone era.
Well, the National Transportation Safety Board does, whenever a plane goes down or has a major problem, they get involved and investigate. And 8 months later, they released a report on this crash. They characterized what was going on as poor cockpit discipline. It's a very milquetoast way of putting it, it seems to me, but that's what they said. So did anything change after they released that finding and used that descriptive to describe what was going on in the cockpit, Scott?
Fortunately, yes. There's something that every single person that gets on a plane today benefits from called the sterile cockpit rule. And the sterile cockpit rule means you cannot talk about anything other than what's going on in the plane and how to fly the plane below 10,000 feet, which takes you through all the takeoffs and all the landings. This didn't come in until a few years later in 1981, but Eastern Flight 212 was one of its main reasons that it's now around. And so do pilots follow it 100% of the time, all the time? No, but certainly way, way more than they did in 1974. So yes, theoretically, that may have saved hundreds of lives we never even know about. So yes, something good happened out of it, the sterile cockpit rule. And nevertheless, despite that, which is a huge thing in aviation history, it remains largely forgotten, Mike, as you mentioned, no marker, there's no memorial. I mean, 99.9% of charlatans, I think, really don't even know this ever happened.
The captain in this flight, Thaden, lost his life. The co-pilot did not. He survived, and he went through the trials that Richard Arnold referred to earlier in this conversation. What happened to him?
Well, so initially, he was fairly badly injured in the crash. Took him a little while to cover, but in a couple of months later, they had the first hearings related to that crash. They had stripped him at that time. They had stripped him of his license. He essentially claimed that he was not at fault, that it was an accident. Eventually, he actually got his license back. I think initially we talked to his daughter. He wasn't interested in flying again. But I think just a year later, he was already trying to get his license back. And a couple of years after that, he did, in fact, get his license back. He was reinstated. He never flew a commercial airplane again, as far as we know. But he did fly cargo planes and private charters for the rest of his life.
Richard,
he just died a couple of years ago.
You went through the trials trying to get compensation for this and also to try to find some accountability on the part of Eastern Airlines and the pilots involved in this. And you watched the co-pilot who survived lose his license, appeal twice, have that license restored. He said it was an accident. He's human. People make mistakes. He made a mistake. How do you feel about it?
Quite frankly, I could forgive him, but he was blind to the cause of the accident. The cause of the accident is clear if you hear the cockpit voice recorder. I've heard it three times, so I can't really tell you what it is because I haven't got it. But the answer is rage, grievance, and that's what they were talking about when they settled into the clouds and hit the ground. They were not looking out the cockpit. The last thing that the air traffic controllers said was, I think it was, Eastern 212, you're too fast, you're too low. Pull up, pull up, pull up. And Daniel just said, yeah, yeah, yeah. That the next thing they said, the famous last words of all pilots, which is, oh, darn. So what is the cause of the plane? It's not just distracted driving. They were in an emotional turmoil talking about politics. Let's just call it politics.
Well, you in the course,
a disgusting thing.
In the course of your conversations with Scott and Thaden, you asked your own questions, some of your own questions about the crash. You asked, was the co-pilot evil or, like you, merely unfortunate? What had happened? Was it preventable? Could it be traced to inadequate pilot training or something else? What conclusions did you reach? Was it simply irresponsible driving, essentially?
Basically, pilots don't get their license and then they fly. They continually go through check flights and training to make sure they're up to speed on proper safety concerns and how you can prevent accidents. And I believe the Eastern Airlines was negligent in their training and their check flights and their times in the simulators. Basically, that's very good practice. And yeah, they talk about things, but they also are being watched and they make sure they look out the window of the simulator during a flight. They have little movies going through the simulator. Right. So it's quite remarkably accurate. And this is the training they were not getting. And we proved pretty carefully that it was an economic decision on the part of Eastern to cut back on safety training. I believe that would have helped a great deal.
I want to go back to something that you talked about, Scott, a second ago, because you said they weren't paying attention to the altimeters, which tells the pilot how far off the ground they are. They silenced an alarm that was telling them that you're too low. They waved off the tower, telling them that they were coming in too fast and coming in too low. You report that the surviving flight attendant, when she helped get the co-pilot out of the cockpit and to safety, asked him if he knew what had happened, and he said, no warning lights went off in the cockpit. Was that a lie? Was he in shock? Because the flight recorder clearly would show the opposite.
Right. And the person we're talking about there is the co-pilot, Jim Daniels. Even though the pilot's technically in charge of the plane, they alternate. And in this case, the co-pilot was the one who flew the plane into the ground. With Reeves was in a supporting role, but it was Daniels that. And in fact, that stewardess or flight attendant, Colette Watson, helped save this co-pilot's life. Pulled him out of the airplane with the help of another passenger named Frank Mihalik and got him onto the ground. And you're right, he said he didn't know what happened. I would say at that point, I mean, he was badly hurt. I think he was in shock and he didn't know what, you know, it was a blur because he had just wrecked a plane at 200 miles an hour that hit the ground. But he also asked at that time for a cigarette right when the plane was burning right next to him, according to the recording of Colette Watson. And that flight attendant, Colette Watson, who's now deceased as well, but we talked at great length with her family, and she had a recording that you referenced earlier that we were able to listen to thanks to her family. She was basically unhurt, Mike. It was unbelievable. If you see pictures, she walked out of that plane like you would walk onto a plane at Charlotte Douglas today. People didn't even think she had been on the plane. So that was another miracle that happened that day.
So Thaden, this, as Scott has pointed out, there is no marker, there is no plaque, there is no indication of where this plane went down. It would be hard for the average person to see it. People live around it. There are other buildings around where the crash took place. And yet there is another crash that took place near the airport that is recognized by the airport. Why has this crash gone unrecognized?
We're not entirely sure. You know, the other crash that you refer to happened in 1994. It was a U.S. Air crash that killed, Scott, do you remember? It was fewer people.
Yeah,
it was
about 37, about half as many, killed about half. Yeah. Still a horrible tragedy, but not this one. Yeah,
there were fewer deaths and more survivors in that crash.
Correct. And that one happened. It was actually adjacent to the airport property at the time. The airport has since bought that property. And that memorial, which is a very nice one, is at the Overlook Park. Perfectly appropriate place for it. Very nice memorial. Honors all the victims and the first responders. As far as the 212 crash site, you know, it's private property. It's not really totally clear anymore where exactly it happened. Probably not necessarily the most appropriate place for a public memorial, 3 miles from the airport. But I think Scott and I both agree that the Overlook Park would also be an appropriate place for a memorial to 212.
Any pushback on that? Have you talked to anybody at the airport? Any pushback to that idea?
So as we mentioned in the story, you know, they said that because it didn't happen on airport property, that was mainly the reason that they don't have one there. I don't think a decision was made. We do think that, you know, at these events we had last week to screen the documentary, the people who are directly connected to the crash, family members, were talking amongst themselves. And we have heard that there is an effort to try to get one done.
I have about 30 seconds left here. Richard, the morning of the crash, you were 31 years old. This morning you are 81, if I've done the math correctly. Looking back, how did this crash affect your life physically, mentally, spiritually?
Gratitude. I need to pay back my community. Anything I can do to support my community and my friends. I volunteer my time. I work hard. And a feeling of social commitment. I didn't do this myself.
This series, 9/11/74, The Crash of Eastern Flight 212, is available at charlotteobserver.com. It's the work of Scott Fowler and Thaden James, who have their own regular beats and spent a considerable amount of time gathering the information and writing this remarkable series of stories. Thank you so much for being with us this morning. Thank you all three for the hour.
Thanks.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.